if you watch the original Rocky movie, which came out in the late 70s, Sylvester Stallone looks credible as a boxer. So you can see muscles. But he looks very different from what he looks like in, say, Rocky III, where he is completely jacked, or what he looks like in Rambo.
He looks like a special effect.
He's a special effect. Welcome to Everyday Abundance, the podcast that explores the hidden histories behind everyday activities and technologies you didn't even know were technologies. I'm Virginia Postrel.
And I'm Charles C. Mann.
In today's episode, we're exploring an activity with which I am woefully unfamiliar. And this woeful unfamiliarity makes me a traitor to my class. That activity is working out. And I am a relatively affluent, well-educated woman living in Los Angeles. And I do not belong to a gym. I do not go to Pilates. I do not practice yoga. I do not do any of these things that are expected of a woman of my type these days. This was not always the case, and it represents one of the biggest lifestyle changes in modern America, and one, ironically enough, in which my family members were early adopters.
So I think I should probably reinforce how weird and sort of just flat crazy what Virginia just said would have sounded to somebody, you know, 150 years ago, if impossibly that could have happened. So there's this famous essay by, you know, George Orwell about Charles Dickens and what the Dickens characters want. What is their goal? And Dickens characters famously are these poor kids who are strivers, and they want to go to the middle class that Virginia and I belong to. And what is the goal? And what they'd want is total indolence. They want to, you know, collect money from lands or whatever and sit around and smoke and drink and eat and you know, chew the fat. And the women are supposed to do the same, except they're gossiping. What they're not doing is exercising. You know, there is no character in Charles Dickens who says, oh, I ate a little bit too much. You know, I'm worried about gout. Let's go and run for 4 miles. You know, there's nobody who says, hey, let's drop down and do 50 push-ups. That's completely alien to them. And the idea that you would have wanted to do this, it's just not even enters their head. So the change that we're talking about is from where something is literally inconceivable and something that's just not even an idea to something that becomes not only an ordinary activity, but something you're actually proud to do.
Right.
You know, like you're ashamed because, you know.
I'm not ashamed, but I should be. You do not have to go back to the 19th century to chart this change. Mm. So what we're going to be talking about is actually a period that starts in the mid-1950s and extends essentially to the mid-80s. There's this tremendous transformation in American and really global culture from a world in which regular exercise was something that was mostly for athletes or people in the military or dancers, you know,
people
who have very specialized skills and interests and professions, to a period where it is expected of normal people. And some of the ways that we can mark this is, what does a leading man look like in Hollywood? So if you go way back, you go back to the there's a famous 1930s movie, It Happened One Night, with Clark Gable, famous for Gone with the Wind, and Claudette Colbert, where Gable takes his shirt off. And what was famous at the time was that he had no undershirt on afterwards. Us looking at it, so Clark Gable is a very good-looking man. He's a leading man. He's fit. But you can't see his muscles in this shirt. Whereas if you were to film that today, a leading man would have muscles.
And well-defined muscles and a six-pack ab.
Exactly. Yeah. You don't have to go back to the 30s. There are many scenes in Star Trek, the original Star Trek, where Captain Kirk takes his shirt off for a medical exam. And you see William Shatner, and he, again, this is in his youth, and he's fit, and he's good looking, and he's sort of a TV leading man, but he's a leading man. And again, you don't see his muscles. It's not, he just looks like a normal.
He's not jacked.
It gets to, you take an even more extreme case. If you watch the original Rocky movie, which came out in the late 70s, Sylvester Stallone looks credible as a boxer. So you can see muscles. But he looks very different from what he looks like in, say, Rocky III, where he is completely jacked, or what he looks like in Rambo.
He looks like a special effect.
He's a special effect because he's come under the influence of Arnold Schwarzenegger, who goes from being a bodybuilder, which is very specialized kind of thing, to being an action star and sets a new standard for action stars in the movie. So Arnold Schwarzenegger, the action star, is not as jacked as Arnold Schwarzenegger, bodybuilder, but he doesn't look like Clark Gable.
He's not like anything anybody's seen before.
Right.
And he kind of embodies, literally, this kind of transformation of what you're supposed to be like.
Right, right. And another thing is, you mentioned running marathons. We're going to, the period that we're talking about goes from a world in which is absolutely inconceivable that some guy with a desk job would decide to run a marathon, unless he was like secretly a runner, all, you know, from high school and college. It was not only inconceivable, but not allowed that a woman would run a marathon.
Well, you know, in marathon, right? It's the original marathon in Greece. The guy runs, goes back, and he drops dead.
Right.
It is seen as this, you know, extraordinary activity that only a few elite people right. can do, to now where you have the Boston Marathon or the LA Marathon, where tens of thousands of people are doing
right.
this.
Exactly. And this is a completely new phenomenon. I mean, again, to run a marathon, to win a marathon is an extraordinary thing done by extraordinary people. To finish a marathon is every year something that regular people do.
I live in a small town and I chop wood, and I said, well, I don't need to go to the gym. I chop wood. And my, you know, regular, you know, middle class, upper middle class friends say, no, that's not the same. You got to go to the gym for your cardio.
Right. And what you're saying about chopping wood is a key piece right. of this story, which is that up until the middle of the 20th century, let's say the post-World War II period, people, and even a little bit later, people didn't have to think about exercising because they got exercise automatically. They got exercise by working. They didn't have to work out. So if you were a farmer, you were doing physical labor all day. If you were a housewife, you were doing physical labor all day. There hadn't been so much, you know, there weren't so many appliances. And when my dad came out of Georgia Tech in the mid-50s as an industrial engineer, he was told, rule of thumb, every factory worker walks about 6 miles in the course of the day. So we don't think of factory worker work as exercise, but even that was a kind of exercise.
And so people were thin. I mean, that was, you know, they just were naturally thin. I had a small experience like that when we lived in Japan for a year. You know, we didn't have a car. We lived in Tokyo, and I had two kids in school, and the schools were like a mile apart. And I had to, you know, walk them to school, walked over here to the school. So I walked like 6 miles a day, and we were broke because it was expensive to live in Japan, and we didn't have that much income. And so I ate kind of a, you know, a 1940s style diet of, you know, relatively small food. I lost 20 pounds.
This goes to something that happened in the mid-50s, especially when you were talking about your kids, which in 1954, there was a study that got a lot of attention. And I suspect this study was bogus in its actual methodology.
We're blowing the whistle. Virginia here is blowing the whistle, but you know, 70 years later.
Basically, what they did was they took a bunch of kids in the U.S. and a bunch of kids in Europe, and they had them do, you know, can you touch your toes? How many sit-ups can you do? They had a bunch of exercises. Almost all European kids could do it. Only 8% couldn't. Over half of the U.S. kids couldn't do it. They couldn't do the exercises. And the conclusion was, the problem is these American kids, they live mechanized lives. They take the bus to school instead of walking. Instead of running around outside playing in the afternoon, when they get home from school, they sit and watch TV.
This is weirdly familiar, what you're describing, because this is like this. There's these recurrent panics in American life about kids these days.
Kids these days.
Not, you know, just sitting there and looking at their phone.
At that time, Dwight D. Eisenhower was president. He had been the general in World War II, and there was, we were reasonably close to the war, and there was like oh no, what if we get in a war? We got all these flabby kids that will make lousy soldiers. Right. So there was that aspect, and it was also during a period of moral panic over juvenile delinquency.
And comic books.
And comic books and so on. So Eisenhower started something called the President's Council on Youth Fitness. Youth fitness included physical fitness and also moral fitness. Mm-hmm. Don't be a juvenile delinquent.
It's a controversial message.
Right, exactly. And then when Kennedy was elected, Kennedy was famous for his emphasis on vigor.
Yeah. Didn't Eisenhower actually have a heart attack or something like that?
I
know that there was this whole thing about indolent, or you know, if Dwight Eisenhower can have a heart attack, what about America's flabby office workers?
Because you used to get exercise going to work in the post-war period. There's this vast expansion of white-collar work,
right,
especially for men. And the other thing that's going on is everybody's smoking, but we're not going to talk about that. But everybody's smoking. And there's a lot of men having heart attacks, including Eisenhower. And Eisenhower is this, like, super fit soldier guy. And it's like, if he can have a heart attack, oh, no. You know.
Yeah.
So there is this kind of worry about heart attacks. And there's a worry about the flabby kids, the flabby baby boomers with all their TV habits. And so... And then the youthful, vigorous John Kennedy, touch football, family playing guy, gets elected president. And he changes the President's Council on Youth Fitness to the President's Council on Physical Fitness.
That's what it's called today, right?
And that's what it's called today. So we're going into the 1960s. We baby boomers start having these President's Council on Physical Fitness tests in elementary school and in gym classes, and it's like, how high can you raise your arm up and how high can you jump and touch? I remember that one. And in fifth grade, I remember I did 40 sit-ups, which 50 was the goal, but 40 was pretty heroic as far as I was concerned. And how many times, sort of what we would today call squats. And so you're going into the 60s, you got the baby boomers, and the turning point in this story of how we have everyday abundance of exercise is really 1967. A book comes out called Jogging, a word that existed, but it wasn't much used. But this book comes out called Jogging. It's by the track coach at University of Oregon, Bill Bowerman, and a cardiologist called W.E. Harris. And the idea is, this is an exercise anybody can do. You don't have to be a tennis player. You don't have to be fit. You don't have to join a country club. You don't have to join a swimming pool. You don't even have to join the Y.
Bowerman, you know, he's a name that's probably now forgotten. Most people don't know. But at the time, was a pretty big name, because he's the head, as you said, of the University of Oregon, which was weirdly famous at that time for having this track program. And there's this charismatic guy named Prefontaine. Who was, you know, this sort of the Jimi Hendrix, if you like, of this kind of thing, this flashy guy who is an apostle for the sport.
But he's saying anybody can do this.
Yeah.
You just, you know, you've got the clothes in your closet already. You put on some shorts that you wear to the beach and T-shirt and your sneakers, which most people had a pair of Keds. And you go out and run around your neighborhood. And so that comes out in 67. And then the following year, in 1968, a former Air Force flight surgeon named Kenneth Cooper comes out with a book called Aerobics. And the idea is, get your heart pumping. And it includes jogging as one of the recommended things, swimming.
Yeah. So what's amazing to think is that, you know, this is not that far. These two words, which everyone knows,
right?
Jogging and aerobics are introduced to the culture. I mean, they existed before.
Yeah,
but
existed, but nobody knew them.
Right.
No, you know.
Yeah.
And so aerobics comes out in 1968, and its gimmick is, it has a point system. Run this far this fast, or swim this far, you get this many points, and you try to have that many points each week. So the other thing that happens in the 1960s is the part where I say my family were early adopters. One part of that story is, my dad is 34 years old, and there's a guy who lives a couple blocks away from us that we know, who's 35 and drops dead of a heart attack. And has a bunch of kids, just like we had three kids, and I think they did too. And my dad is like, yikes. Now, my father doesn't.
I mean, this is a reasonable.
Right. So he doesn't smoke or drink. I don't know about this other guy. But he's overweight. He's not the fit young guy he was 10 years earlier. Mm-hmm. And so he decides, I'm going to lose 35 pounds before my 35th birthday, which is toward the end of the next year. So he takes the book Aerobics. and he starts jogging and running.
But this is part of a national thing. I mean, there is what was called a heart attack epidemic, and you know, on the cover of Newsweek and Time, the big news were pictures of guys with with like these
EKGs,
medical charts,
yeah,
and EKGs,
right.
and so forth. There is a national panic about people like that 34-year-old, and it was real. It was real.
Right.
There was my grandfather dropped dead. Everybody knew somebody like this.
Yeah, my father-in-law had a heart attack when he was something like 28, before my husband was even born.
Wow.
So that also led to a lot of research on cardiology and stuff. But you have this, so you're in the late 60s, and as you say, aerobics and jogging become part of the everyday vocabulary. My dad was silent generation, but it's very much a baby boomer phenomenon. You start to have the growth of what we can call a fitness industry.
Right.
This is sort of what we're talking about. It's like, how did this become sort of a normal part of life with all the abundant stuff and activities that are accompanying
right,
that?
Right, because today's fitness is not just a matter of putting on your shorts and going running.
Right. You have specialized shoes, apparel, equipment, et cetera. So we have to go back a little on that story. We have to go back a little bit in time to 1964 when Bill Bowerman, the Oregon coach and a partner, start a company called Blue Ribbon Sports. And what Blue Ribbon Sports does is it imports better running shoes from Japan. And it's really sort of oriented toward athletes. This is not really for the everyday jogger.
Right, right.
But
there isn't an everyday jogger.
There isn't an everyday
jogger.
Because
it's just a few years before that.
But over time, they start to look out to the everyday person. And in 1971, Blue Ribbon Sports changes its name. And its name, they changed the name to Nike.
And there's an important thing here that Virginia's kind of hiding. Who was Bowerman's partner?
Partner, yes, yeah. I was hiding that. His name is Phil Knight.
Yeah.
Which,
if you don't know, is a name you shouldn't know, because these guys changed American culture.
Yeah. And I'll tell a little bit more about Phil Knight, but first, another thing that Bowerman did. So up until the 70s, if you were a track runner, an athlete, you would run in cleats to grip the track. And they're kind of heavy. Of course, runners want their shoes to be as light as possible because go faster. So Bowerman starts fooling around with different kinds of soles.
It's also, cleats are not something an ordinary person.
No, and you can't, it's just put them on for
They had little metal spikes.
Yeah, right. So Bowerman starts fooling around. He develops something called the waffle trainer, a waffle sole, which is hard for me to believe that this was not around until 1974, but it wasn't.
And somebody actually invented it, and it was him.
Right, and he actually used a waffle iron. I mean, obviously, eventually they manufactured it, but when he was doing prototypes, he actually used a waffle iron. So that comes out in 1974, and that is something that Nike sells to regular people as well as, athletes. But the distribution isn't what it later becomes. Yeah. It's not like every store has a Nike, will sell you Nikes. And then in 1977 is another sort of turning point, especially in the history of Nike, but also in the history of how we think about sort of athletic attire, which is there's an aerospace engineer named Frank Rudy. He works for NASA. And while he's working for NASA, he sees a process that's called blown rubber molding, or sometimes just called blown molding, because sometimes they're using plastic. And it's a way of creating a structure around air.
A bubble. Or a balloon or something like that.
Except that in a lot of uses, the point is the outside.
Right.
The point is not the air. The point is just you need a part or a bottle or whatever of a certain shape. Rudy starts thinking, he thinks about the bubble. He thinks about the air. And he leaves NASA and becomes an independent inventor. And one of the things he invents is a prototype for something that would cushion your feet when you're running or walking.
So the idea is you have this bubble and you step on it and it compresses the air, but it's like a cushion.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So he comes up with an air sole. And he's trying to license it, sell it, going around trying to get meetings with everybody. Yeah. Nobody wants to meet with them. You know?
It's very, so the classic inventor.
It's a classic.
With a great idea that nobody can see.
Exactly. It's a classic inventor. And he doesn't make shoes. He makes like an insole. Yeah. So he gets a meeting with Phil Knight at Nike. And he comes in and he's showing him the airsole and he's giving him the spiel. Yeah. And Phil Knight later writes, he's like, basically, he thought he was crazy. He was like, this is like comic book stuff.
Right.
It reminded him of moving sidewalks and jetpacks. It was like, yeah.
Space shoes.
You're crazy. You know, it's like these inventors who've read too many copies of amazing stories or whatever. But Knight says, okay, I'll take your insoles and I'll put them in my, can I put them in my shoes? And he says, okay. And he puts them in his shoes and he goes on a 6-mile run. And when he comes back, he was like, yeah, we can work with you. We'll do this. And it also helps that Rudy mentions Adidas at some point, which is the competition. So they want to get it. And they cut a deal. We don't know the exact deal, but we do know Knight offers Rudy 10 cents for every pair of shoes that are sold with this airsole. Mm. And Rudy counters with 20 cents, and they meet somewhere in the middle. And needless to say, both Frank Rudy and Nike get very, very rich.
Frank Rudy gets 15 cents every time
somebody sells
that's a lot of 15
a pair
cents.
Of Nikes that use the airsole.
Yeah.
And so it debuts in 1977. Yeah. At the beginning, it's oriented toward track, but of course, it becomes really famous with the Air Jordan shoes,
right.
Which is in 1984. And then there's a later, I forget the date, but there's a later design that actually shows the airsole where you can see it.
So one thing I'm wondering about here is, are people taking these shoes and all this equipment, you know, to the gym? I mean,
So that's the other piece. So that's the other piece of this expansion of the fitness industry. During this period, you're also getting gyms. Now, there were gyms before. Obviously, people could go to the YMCA.
But those are like weren't gyms, you know, that weren't like in a high school, but are commercial gyms.
Right.
They were boxing places, right?
They were very boxing oriented. They were very. They had a real kind of blue collar feel to them.
You're being nice. See, they're down market.
They're down market. Exactly. They were down market and they were also all male. In the 1970s, that starts to change. There's a guy named Arthur Jones, and he has a theory about how athletes should train. And his theory is that free weights aren't good. One thing about gym culture to this day is everybody's got a theory of the proper way to train.
As a science reporter, we would say we should note that these theories have, I think, what we call it, slim empirical backing.
Everybody's got a theory. But
yeah.
Arthur Jones's theory is that you need to separate the different muscle groups and exercise each one at the separately. The other thing you need to do is, as you move through the motion, instead of the amount of resistance varying,
with a
barbell, you need to keep it the same. So he invents this mechanism and these machines that are called Nautilus machines.
Right.
Again, his motivation for inventing it is better training for people who are serious about pumping up, a term we will get to. But the Nautilus machines have some other advantages. One is that they are basically idiot-proof.
Weightlifting, you can actually hurt yourself
you
by being an idiot.
You can hurt yourself. You need a spotter. You need to learn how to do it properly and probably over. The Nautilus machines, you join a gym and there was a chain of Nautilus. Yeah. There was a chain that Arthur Jones started.
He was the Nautilus guy,
but then also other people would buy the machines and put them in. So they're kind of idiot proof. And the other thing,
you could paint them.
Yeah, well, that's what he they came with this very appealing sort of metallic blue paint.
They look cool.
They look cool and they looked upscale.
Oh, right.
That's the important thing. They looked upscale. And so you've got these yuppies, as they began to be called in the early 80s, who start to go to upscale gyms, many of which have Nautilus machines.
And these things also have another feature. They have women in them.
Yes. And these upscale gyms are co-ed.
So do you think that this was done, you know, in a sense, deliberately that the Nautilus people said, wait a minute, there is 50% of the human race that is not, you know, that is not, we could get them? Or is it just they had this idea and it was a byproduct?
Well, yeah. I don't know about Arthur Jones, but yeah. I do know about somebody named Frank Bond who started, they call Holiday Spas.
Okay.
I think that's what it was called.
Spa.
It was I don't even know if it's called, but anyway, he started a chain and he came out of the boxing world. His dad was a boxer and stuff. And he was a very entrepreneurial fellow, loved Ayn Rand. Yeah. I actually knew him. Frank, it is safe to say, was not a feminist.
Right.
He was a smart businessman. He made a lot of money in the gym industry. Yeah. One of the smart things he did was from the very beginning, he opened his gyms to women and made them so that they were appealing.
And this was incredibly successful. I mean,
yeah,
because it becomes really rapidly part of the culture. And you have these movies, you know, like
right.
Perfect is the one.
So the other thing that happens on the women's side of gym is there's this great expansion of what is often just called aerobics at the time,
right.
but it's really more accurately described as dance aerobics.
Okay.
So these routines that use kind of dance moves, dance routines to get your heart pumping.
Right. And to make, but also in a way that's sort of female coded.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And the most famous one is Jane Fonda's workout videos.
Yes. Reinventing yourself for the 12th time.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's one of the Jane Fonda's many reinventions. And it's a kind of, it is female coded, as you said. And there's a kind of fitness aspect to it that is different from, there had been earlier kinds of exercise routines for women. In the 1950s, a head of his time guy named Jack LaLanne had a TV show that was oriented toward housewives, and it was basically calisthenics of various kinds.
Right.
Jack LaLanne, you could transport him through time to 2026, and he would fit right in.
Mm-hmm.
He had a whole wellness thing about diet and fitness for everyone. At the time, in terms of the TV show, it was marketed to, you know, keep your slender figure. So there were things for women, but the idea of working up a sweat and you're not a dancer, but you're wearing leotards and tights. So there's this whole sort of feminist area. And then the other thing that's interesting about this sort of dance aerobics craze is, of course, I wrote Fabric of Civilization, so there's always got to be a textile angle.
This is a feature of all shows sooner or later it's going to come to textiles.
We're going to work it around to textiles. DuPont has this amazing research division, and they're famous for inventing nylon. And one of the fibers they come up with is Lycra. That's the brand name, or spandex is a more generic. Lycra nowadays is like in everything.
No, I should just make that clear, because I think a certain number of people are going to say, Lycra is the same as spandex?
Yes.
Yes,
exactly.
They are the same. Right.
They are the same. DuPont comes up with Lycra, and the reason they come up with Lycra is they think this will be really great for girdles.
It's sort of like coming up with a new material for buggy whips just before the car comes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they come up with Lycra, and it is really a lot better for girls. And it, you know, fast forward to today, and nowadays we don't talk about girdles, but we have, you know, foundation garment and waist trainers and all of these things. And they, you know, and Kim Kardashian Slimline and all these things. And they all have Lycra in them, but as well as our jeans
so
and our
actually,
shirts
does
and
turn out to be
everything.
Good for girdles.
I mean, this shirt that I'm wearing has a little bit of Lycra in it. Now it's in everything. But going back to the 1960s, DuPont has Lycra. They think, oh, we're going to hit it rich. It's going to be like nylon with women's stockings. And they do put Lycra also in stockings. The thing about Lycra is it's stretchy, but it doesn't stretch out permanently the way rubber is intended. It's very good at going back. Right around that time, for various reasons, including feminism, but also, you know, just the youth culture in general, girdles go out of fashion.
Right.
No.
So, so what there is mighty gnashing of teeth in the executive suites of DuPont.
And the aerobics, quote unquote, craze, dance aerobics, saves Lycra.
Hooray.
Right? Because suddenly all these women were buying, you know, several leotards and accompanying tights to wear to the gym to do aerobics or whatever. And so that is the sort of textile story of the gym part of it. Meanwhile, there's a whole phenomenon we haven't been talking about. So we've been talking about like going jogging or running, going to the gym. There's this other boomer phenomenon, which is everybody becomes very outdoorsy.
Right.
Climbing mountains.
So I grew up in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And my college classmates all, you know, some of them get to be lawyers and, you know, and so forth and work in corporate jobs. And the deal is if you go to Perkins Coie, which is this gigantic law firm, and you don't talk like madmen, but, you know, on Monday morning, what you do is you come into Perkins Coie in your suit and you say, I went out yesterday and I climbed Mount Rainier, or I paddled down this, or, you know, I went skin diving or something.
Right.
You're doing these very fit type outdoorsy activities that also require you to buy oodles and oodles of equipment.
Right. So this is like, it's extreme in the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
To this day, it's more extreme in the Pacific Northwest than any place else.
It's the beginning of the Pacific Northwest's role in becoming an eccentric outlier and leader in culture.
Well, yeah, I was going to say it's beginning of the Pacific Northwest becoming the headquarters of giant companies.
Beginning with things like REI.
REI, Nike.
Right, which are, you know, REI started by an actual, you know, mountain climber,
right?
Jim Whittaker, who, you know, ascended Everest.
Right, yeah. So you get all these companies and they start to think, so it used to be that if you went mountain climbing, you have to have the right apparel,
right,
in general, if you're going to get at any altitude, whatever, you would wear things that were made out of wool or waffle weed cotton base layers. These natural fibers have some disadvantages,
right,
especially having to do with water,
right,
i.e. sweat. You want to get it away from your body and have it evaporate, but you don't want to get cold, and there's thermal management, and so
they're technical problems.
They're technical problems. So this is the opposite of DuPont, where they invent a fiber and say, what can we sell for, girls or stockings, or whatever. This is like, we have technical problems that need apparel solutions.
Right.
Remember polyester in the 70s?
The triple knit ugly stuff that everybody
would
make.
So polyester is big in the 70s. All the women go back to work wearing their polyester pants suits. There's disco. And by 1981, I'm working as an intern in the Wall Street Journal's Philadelphia Bureau. And my colleague there who covers DuPont writes this story about how DuPont is mounting this marketing campaign to try to make polyester cool again, because everybody hates polyester. But it has a lead that I love, love, love. Pity poor polyester. People pick on it. Ron is writing this article about all these people doing all this marketing stuff.
Yeah.
And all this marketing stuff that they do has absolutely no effect on making polyester cool.
No, it's like thuddingly uncool.
It just, you know, they spend a lot of money. It doesn't work. However, if you look at your closet today, it's full of polyester.
Right.
What happens is polyester is saved by the outdoor apparel business, because polyester has some properties that are very useful. It is extruded, as many synthetic fibers are. You have this kind of viscous gunk.
Goo.
Now
that's the technical language.
Yeah. And it's pushed through what is called a spinneret. Picture a shower head.
Yeah.
Or
little nozzles.
Right. Or even better, if you can remember, if you ever played with Play-Doh and you put the Play-Doh in the little plastic thing with a lever on it that you pushed through, and you could make, you know, a big long snake of that's the shape of a star.
Right,
or a
right.
Big
it kind of squidges through.
It would have a shape at the the front, like a template or a, and it would make a line of star. Well, that you can do that with polyester. So polyester, it can be different shapes.
Right.
And the other thing about polyester is, unlike wool or cotton, it is hydrophobic. It repels water.
Right.
It doesn't like water. And also, people have figured out, starting in Japan, of how to make polyester very, very fine, to make polyester microfibers, which nowadays people worry about some of the effects of that in the water, but polyester has become more versatile. You get, first of all, Patagonia starts an R&D department for apparel or a research department. Right. Now, they're not actually making new
fiber. When you think about it, this is sort of weird, like a clothing company with a research division.
Yes, this is a new thing. And this is not general in the apparel business, but in the outdoor apparel.
But it's more general now. Uniqlo has a big lab where they develop fabrics.
And, so, and been to the lab at Under Armour.
Yeah.
And so particularly these performance fabrics for athletes and for then for casual people going to the gym, they start to develop fabrics that are designed to do things like wick sweat off you.
Right.
Or
so this would be like fleece.
Fleece is the first one.
Yeah.
Fleece is developed by a company called Malden Mills for Patagonia.
Mm-hmm.
And it is much lighter weight. People use microfibers to create alternatives to down in down vests and down coats so that you can have warmth and lightweight, but you don't have to look like the Michelin man. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember down jackets around 1980-ish, late 70s.
I had a down jacket.
Yeah.
I was legally obliged. You know, there's a contract that every person in the Northwest has to have a down jacket, right? Because you do outdoorsy things. Right,
right. So over time, you get all these different kinds of apparel. And that is one of the things that comes out of the sort of whole idea that exercise, whether it's at the gym or on the track, is something that is expected of normal, respectable people.
Right.
And just some statistics to give some idea of how big this is. And unfortunately, you can't even get statistics going back to before about 2000. How many people, how many gyms are, how many people belong to them? But about 77 million Americans belong or have paid for some type of membership to a gym or a yoga studio or even potentially an app.
Right. This is, so this is even larger than it seems because that figure, of course, excludes, you know, huge numbers of 70s and 80-year-olds, you know,
and
kids.
And kids. So
right.
It's
Which
larger,
is a lot of people.
It's larger than it seems, but it's also smaller than it seems because it also includes people whose New Year resolution is to work out and they join
but
the
gym. But that's evidence of the culture because, again, Charles Dickens did not make New Year's resolutions to do this.
Nowadays, there are about 12 gyms for every 100,000 Americans. And that's actually, there's been some consolidation. So some of these gyms are, there's actually fewer, but some of them are larger. And then there've also been specialized things like, you know, a hot yoga studio.
Right. Instead of being something you flee from, right?
Right.
It's that you become something that you embrace.
Embrace.
In New York or Boston, you go to, you know, hey, got to leave early for the gym, right? It's all part of this thing.
Right.
And the types of people who are like you and me who, you know, oh, yuck, they are feeling enormous social pressure. My kids, I don't think, are natural exercisers, but they routinely do this because it is part of what you do when you're 27.
Right, right. So I figure if I'd been born in 1990 instead of 1960,
you would not be a traitor to your class.
I would not be a traitor to my class. I would actually belong to the gym. Thank you for joining us for Everyday Abundance. This podcast is sponsored by the Abundance Institute, and you can find all the episodes and show notes on their website at abundance.institute. Very easy to remember. Also easy to remember is our YouTube channel, Everyday-Abundance. Please subscribe. You can also find episodes wherever you get podcasts. Our producer is Toby Murashanu, and the music was written and performed by John Harden.
If you like this and want to support us, the most important thing you can do is actually leave a review. And this matters in ways that the gods of the algorithm are best able to explain.